540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. In Chicago, five TikTok content creators have filed a lawsuit to overturn a planned ban on the video sharing app in Montana. Loyola Law Professor Lori Levinson.
As the court looks at this lawsuit, I think they'll be concerned about whether this violates the First Amendment. Now, that doesn't mean that there can't be some restrictions on TikTok, certainly as we've seen that the government authorities, employees cannot use it. But when it comes to private citizens, the First Amendment's at play.
Republican Governor Greg Gianforte says the ban will protect Montana residents' personal information from being harvested by the Chinese government. Some missed red flags are coming to light in connection with the Air National Guardsman charged with leaking highly classified military documents. Prosecutors say Jack Texera's superiors caught him mishandling secrets even before his arrest. CBS's Catherine Herridge.
What these records show is that these internal security procedures did flag Texera, but a decision was made by his supervisors to let him stay in that position and retain the security clearance, which allowed him, according to prosecutors, to allegedly leak all of these documents online.
Near Albany, Oregon, at least seven people have died and others have been hurt in a crash involving two semi-trucks and a passenger vehicle on I-5. Police in New Mexico released video of Monday's shooting rampage that left three dead in Farmington. Police Chief Steve Hebby says the high school student on the verge of graduating seemed keen on ending his life.
He has opportunities to run off. He does not use those opportunities. So, yes, it's my belief that ultimately in his head, he's made a decision that he's going to stand and fight it out until he's killed.
Vatican police arrest a man who they say drove through a gate and reached a palace courtyard before being detained. CBS's Anna Matranga.
A statement from the Holy See said the car was driven by a man about 40 years of age with obvious psychiatric problems who voluntarily gave himself up.
Our Christopher Cruz on a dispute over the ivory-billed woodpecker.
Federal officials are planning to make a final decision about whether the bird is extinct by the end of this year. In 2021, they said there's no evidence the bird exists. But a group that spent more than a decade searching for them disagrees. Lead study author Stephen Latta with the Independent National Aviary in Pittsburgh.
This cumulative body of evidence from this multi-year search that leaves us confident that this iconic species does indeed exist.
Naval Research Laboratory scientist Michael Collins has published numerous papers on ivory-billed woodpeckers. He says the videos show a similar but smaller bird.
ChatGPT makes its debut as a smartphone app on iPhones. This is CBS News.
Need to hire quality candidates fast? You need Indeed. Their powerful hiring platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Zogallo Food Truck Park is so much fun. They have such variety in one place. You name it. Ice cream, bagels, sushi, tacos, pizza, to tasty sandwiches, and a fun full bar to boot with some craft cocktails and beers. You can even host a private party or reserve a heated hut. Support local food entrepreneurs with family and friends and taste milk. Milwaukee. Open Tuesday through Sunday. Find us at ZocaloMKE.com. That's ZocaloMKE.com.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matinair. Here's what you need to know. Mequon police shot and killed a man Wednesday afternoon while responding to a neighbor dispute involving a gun. The Wisconsin Department of Justice says officers responded to a report of shots fired and found the man barricaded in a home. When he exited, the man fired at officers, at which time he was shot and killed. No officers were injured. The Mequon officer involved in the shooting has been placed on administrative leave. The number of stolen vehicles are on the rise in Waukesha County. The Waukesha County Sheriff's Office has responded to multiple calls for entry into unlocked cars, resulting in at least five cars being stolen from the town of Delafield, City of Pewaukee, Sussex, Merton, and Lannan. Nearly all were taken after the vehicle's keys or fobs were left inside of the unlocked vehicle. I'm Jane Matinair. This is Civic Media News.
Every family has one. The Smother.
Holy why!
Hi, Erica! Okay.
This is my daughter. I baked her in my tummy.
The Goldbergs every weeknight.
Weeknights at 5 and 5:30 on My 24.
With a house full of women, it's every man for himself.
What is it about hanging bras in the bathroom like Christmas ornaments? If I don't hang my underwear in the bathroom, that would be terrifying.
Tim Allen is the last man standing.
Weeknights at 6 and 6:30 on My24.
Hi, this is Lindsay Kynard at 5:40 a.m. and 101.1 FM WAUK The Shaw. Here are upcoming events happening in the area.
Celebrate Wisconsin Day in Chicago this Wednesday the 17th, presented by Visit Milwaukee at Union Station, featuring a beer garden, food beverages, and entertainment from 8 a.m. till 6 p.m. Check out the Spring Sustainable Food Series on Thursday the 18th, presented by Urban Ecology Center at Riverside Park. It's free and runs from 6 until 8 p.m. See the contenders at the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center in Brookfield on Friday the 19th. Call 262-781-9520 for tickets. On Saturday the 20th, enjoy the Armed Forces Day celebration at the Harley-Davidson Museum from 10 a.m. till 3 p.m. And finally, enjoy Caribbean food and tropical drinks and music at Afro-Sosh Brunch this Sunday the 21st from 1 until 5 p.m. That's at North Water Street in Milwaukee.
If you have an event you'd like us to share, let me know. Email me, Lindsay Kynard, at info@civicmedia.us.
Local radio for your community. Civic Media, broadcasting across the state of Wisconsin. Continue the conversation online. Find and follow Civic Media on Facebook and on Twitter.
Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Tuesday, the Senate Banking Committee held a hearing where the former Chief Executive Officer of the Silicon Valley Bank, Greg Becker, testified that he didn't know. He was completely unaware the bank was in trouble. Had not a clue. Didn't know. Now, granted, he did sell his shares of the bank, you know, weeks before, but never mind. Just bad timing. I got to tell you, I'm not buying the testimony, but his quote was, "I believe it was a series of unprecedented events that all came together in the fastest bank run in history." What's my fault? It wasn't me. It was somebody else. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the testimony. And if anyone's buying it, I've asked my good friend Morris Pearl to come share some thoughts. Morris is the chair of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, the website. Morris, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, it's great to be in your show, Rick.
Now, you've been a corporate bigwig. You've been in those boardrooms. Does this excuse, who could have known? I didn't. I was completely shocked. Would that ever fly?
Well, I mean, I don't know if he committed a crime, but I think it's absurd. I mean, Senator Sherrod Brown says, "It sounds worse than your dog ate your homework." I mean, I think that's an exact quote.
Yep.
You know, what I told my guys after I've read it is it's, you know, unprecedented if you're too young to have heard of, you know, where's the beef and who you're going to call, you know, and ET phone home. Because these things happened before.
Right.
It happened in the 1970s, the 1980s. And yeah, maybe he's too young to remember those things. But interest rates do sometimes go up. So it's not unprecedented. It's maybe unprecedented for him, but it's like the most ridiculous thing. I mean, he blames everybody except for himself. And like, what kind of leadership is that? You know, is that what they teach you in, I don't know where, but I don't think that's what like, they teach you in West Point about leadership is blame someone else if something goes wrong.
Well, I got to think this is the defense of please don't convict me. Please don't send me to jail kind of thing. And please don't look into if there were any crimes. Just, you know, trying to play the, hey, I was stupid. I made it. I think it was the guy from Louisiana, John Kennedy, who said that he made a stupid bet. And the American people now are going to have to pick up the tab for his stupid bet. And I would have been okay with that. Hey, we over-leveraged a little bit. We were a little more aggressive than we should be. I would go, yeah, I get that. But the fact that they didn't have a risk officer for quite some time, if I remember. Am I getting that? Do I remember that right?
Yeah. The position of chief risk officer is vacant for most of 2022. And he talks about like having made low-risk investments. he made low-risk investments, you know, guaranteed by the Treasury, but they were mortgages guaranteed for timely payment of principal and interest. But he was used to having these mortgages at extremely low interest rates that people were refinancing, you know, at several percent per month. So most people took out a mortgage, and on average, they're pay, you know, 30% of people are paying off their mortgages every year. Now it's 4% when interest rates have gone up. But that's the kind of thing that they that you look at. I mean, the first questions from the Federal Home Loan Bank of the banks they regulate is interest rates going down 3%, 3 percentage points, interest rates going up 3 percentage points. I mean, like, he didn't know it was going to happen, but he knew, he should have known it could have happened. And he said he wasn't on the Asset Liability Committee. Well, that's an excuse that he delegated, you know? I was like...
Yeah, that's not a good excuse, though. It wouldn't have flown for me if I went home and told my mother that. I had someone else do it. It wouldn't have flown.
Yeah, it was so ridiculous. I mean, no one told him, oh, we're not going to raise interest rates. You know, he came with a quote from the Jerome Powell about the transitory. Well, because inflation is transitory, that means interest rates aren't going to go up. Well, are you bonkers? Do you know inflation is transitory? And even if it is transitory, they might raise interest rates anyway. And even if they don't raise interest rates, your mortgages might go down in value anyway. And like, there's lots of things that can happen. It's just so absurd that this guy, I mean, I think, I mean, I haven't done everything perfect in my life. But those times we made mistakes with people's money, say, yes, we made a mistake. You know, yes, these people were working under me and I approved what they did and it was wrong. Sorry, you know, but yeah. It wasn't like that. You know, it was like he's sorry that his former friends aren't like part of his social life anymore. That's what he's sorry about.
But here's the question that I keep coming back to, because I've had a bunch of conservatives tell me this is the reason why we shouldn't be backing these banks and they should all fail, is because it creates an environment where a CEO like this knows that they're going to get bailed out, so that they make on purpose, you know, over leveraged, much more risky type decisions, because they know eventually the taxpayer is going to be the backstop. Do you buy any of that?
Well, it's not that he got bailed out. I mean, he's unemployed, and he did indeed lose the value of much of his stock. I mean, he didn't sell all of it. The bank didn't get bailed out. The people that run the bank didn't get bailed out, and the investors. What got bailed out was the depositors, so first of all. So it's not like – but yes, you're right. He is an incentive to do risky things, because if it works, he makes big money. You know, his shares go up in price. He makes more bonuses. If it doesn't work, the worst case for him is he loses his job.
Right.
Is what indeed happened. So, yes, I mean, I honestly think they're right to some extent. And I'm not going to say the guy's evil.
No. Look, any one of us, I think, if we had the ability to take huge risks and know our opportunity costs are going to be limited, you know, I think a lot of us would take those bigger risks. And this is where I'm coming back to. Is this a government regulation problem? Is this something we need to be doing more to oversee? Does there need to be more insurance into this to ensure that what's the way forward? It's one thing to beat up on this guy. Okay, he's an idiot. He's stupid. I think you put it as you wouldn't trust him enough to give him a job as a school crossing guard. Okay, I get that. That's a good made me laugh. But how do we go forward and make sure that there isn't the next series of these happening down the road, where we should have done the due diligence to protect the not just the banks, but the taxpayers?
Well, there could be another one. And the thing is, if you're in the bank situation, if you're in the situation where you're investing other people's money, but you get part of the profit, but none of the losses, well, you have an incentive to take more risk. Say that 100 people gave me their money to invest. I got a percentage of the profit. And if there's no regulation at all and I could do whatever I wanted, I would take half the money and put it on black and half the money and put it on red. And I tell those half the customers who won, I tell them, oh, we made a lot of, we doubled your money for you. And I'll, here's my percentage of the profit. And the rest of the customers, oh, sorry, we lost all your money. And I'd be doing great, you know, but that's why we have regulation. That's why the Fed and the FDIC regulate banks specifically so they don't do that. And so, obviously something that obvious they wouldn't do. But they were trying to do that kind of thing with somewhat less obviously.
Okay. So there was something happening. Because I still want to pull Peter Navarro into this. Because there's still, you know, I've still got people going, you know, did he trigger this? Or was he just the one smart enough to go, hey, this is in trouble. I got to protect myself. So I'm curious, is there any part of this for him in this?
I don't know. But I don't think there was a reason that people would deliberately want the bank to fail. I think there were people who could read the reports and see that they had all this mortgage-backed securities in the end of December in the report that was published in February. And know that, oh, rates are going up. These things have already gone down in value so much that as of December, your bank was on the edge of being insolvent. So now that rates have gone up even more in March, well, you're even more insolvent and probably over the edge. And, you know, if they thought that they had uninsured deposits, yeah, it makes a lot of sense to withdraw your money, you know, and do something else with it.
How much of this do you think is the fact that we've had such low interest rates for so long that people just never thought that anything could never see the kind of interest rates we see now?
I hope you're right. I hope that's the actual answer, that he really was making a stupid bet, in Senator Kennedy's words. I can't imagine someone being a CEO of a bank and being that stupid. It doesn't make any sense to me. It's like he failed asset management 101. I think one of the senators said that too. And like, it's just, and even most banks aren't failing, of course.
Right.
We have thousands of banks in our country. You know, three or four of them failed in the last few months since interest rates have been going up. So it's not like all bankers are stupid.
So let me ask you this then, since it's only these handful, because, you know, I've had a bunch of people say, oh my God, the sky's falling. You know, businesses fail all the time. Is it unprecedented for banks to go under? I mean, you're the investment guru. Is it unusual that a bank goes under at any time?
No, I mean, there weren't any the year before last. But there typically been, you know, 5 or 10 banks going out of business a year, taken over by the FDIC. The FDIC, the regulators, the FDIC has closed 5 or 10 banks a year in a typical year, mostly small banks, very rarely banks as big as these, right. And not for years. But yeah, I mean, I think we need the regulation because they have either deliberately or accidentally, you know, the kind of thing I was talking about with putting half the money on red and half on black. You know, I mean, whether it's on purpose or through stupidity, either way, it doesn't really matter. We need regulators who are keeping an eye on them and not letting them do that. And these regulators, at least some people at the Fed, saw what was going on months earlier, like almost a year ago, last summer.
Right. That's what I was going to ask you, because Sherrod Brown, in his testimony, said, you know, why did you ignore all the admonishments? Admonitions is the word he used, from regulators. You know, and he said the answer is simple. It's the same that we find in most bank failures, because executives were getting rich. That was his. So for him to say it's unprecedented, for him to say he didn't know, did regulators, you know, as you've said, you know, highlight this stuff so that they could fix it, or was it too far gone?
It wasn't too far gone last summer, and it was, I mean, the regulators did notify the bank executives, but the bank decided to continue doing what they were doing.
Yeah.
And I mean, the regulators don't want to, they want the bank to be profitable. The best way to have a bank not lose money is for the bank to make a lot of profits. So that's sort of on one side of the regulatory idea.
Yeah, because that's usually what happens when you don't lose a lot of money, you make profits.
Yeah. So the first thing is the regulator wants the bank not to lose money. So therefore, the regulator wants the bank to be profitable. So the regulator is kind of predisposed to listen to the bank and say, well, if we do this and this and this, that will help us make profits. Because the regulator wants the bank to make profits.
Right.
But these regulators knew this was highly risky, and they had either they lacked the authority or they lacked the wherewithal to make the bank stop doing it. I mean, frankly, they should have closed the bank down in like August or September, not waited till March.
So let me ask you last question I've got for you.
A little more quickly with Signature and some of the other banks.
Right. So last question I've got for you, because, you know, we've got these handful, as you've pointed out, there's just a handful of these banks. If we don't come up with a debt deal and the U.S. defaults, how much of the banking industry is in trouble because of this stuff? Or aren't they connected?
Well, if we don't come up with a deal and, you know, Congress and the president, the U.S. will run out of money to pay its bills. Now, probably it will stop paying other bills before it stops paying interest on U.S. government treasuries. But if treasuries stop being risk-free, then a lot of banks will be in trouble. I mean, maybe even all of them. You know, I think the whole banking system depends on the fact that they can put their money in the Fed and it's invested in treasury bonds and notes and bills, and those are risk-free. If that fails, then, I mean, a lot of banks will be insolvent then. What this bank saw, U.S. Treasury guaranteed things go down in value by 12%, and that's just because rates went up, not even because the U.S. government had a credit problem. If the U.S. government actually has a credit problem, they'll go down a lot more, and a lot of banks will have problems.
So more fun to look forward to in the next month. But Morris, as always, I appreciate the time. Thanks for the information and keeping us up to date.
Great to be in the show, Rick. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Our good friend Morris Pearl, chair of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, the website. If you want to take a look at the work that they do, and I highly suggest you do. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I got to tell you, I'm struck by the CEO going, no, it was unprecedented. Yeah, what's unprecedented, I think, and I forgot to ask Morris this. What's unprecedented is to not have a risk officer for almost a whole year. I got to think that's unprecedented. I got to think it's unprecedented to leave yourself wide open and vulnerable. And look, this is where I don't disagree with some of my friends on the right. By having this backstop, it makes people feel invincible. It makes them go, hey, we can take huge risks because, well, we're not going to pay the full freight. Yeah, we're going to lose our job. We're going to lose some of our stock maybe. But the opportunity to roll the dice and win big is the allure is way too big. And when you're literally the house, when you're the bank, I got to think that kind of thought process is, well, even more godlike, if you will. And the weird thing is, you know, I fear with this debt ceiling thing, you know, just just around the corner. If we do default and we do have another run on the banks like this, because the one thing the guy's right about, it was the fastest run on a bank in history. And we're talking, you know, what was it, you know, $40 billion in the matter of minutes? Because everything's digital, everything's electronic. I can go in, I want my money now, doom, I've got it. It's not like you had to wait in line behind the teller like the old days when they could close the window, say, sorry, we've locked the window. If we do default and we do head towards this, the dominoes could be really bad. I saw a headline today said, U.S. weekly jobless claims fall. Labor market defying recession. And I'm going, it's almost like they want. It's almost like they need the recession. It's almost like, you know, it's one of those things, oh, we're hoping and we're going to make it happen. Because it really is all about making Biden look and the Democrats look bad. That's all it's about. They don't give a tinker's damn about you or anyone else. Because if they did, they wouldn't be doing this. Just crazy to me. And look, all the other things that come along with it. Remember, Republicans don't want regulations. They don't want oversight. They don't want a cop on the beat, so to speak, so that they can get away with all the things they've been getting away with. So, you know, shutting off the financial spigot to fund government, the regulatory bodies that oversee the big moneyed interests, you know, they think that's okay. For instance, Department of Labor. I get every day 30 emails from the Department of Labor. And it's always, hey, we found this wage theft case. Hey, we found, you know, this company cheating these people out of overtime, cheating them out of minimum wage, cheating them out of tips. And it's this one out of Honolulu that this, you know, the Department of Labor, you know, said, look, you know, this company had to pay, you know, something like $92,000 in unpaid wages and damages to these workers because the company was stealing their tips. Literally, the management was stealing the workers' tips. And this is one of those things that it infuriates me because I know people who have said, yeah, you know, we throw our tips into a pool and, we pay everybody out of the pool. I go, well, I didn't give you that tip to be pooled with the management. I put that on the table for the person who was doing the job. And I think a lot of people think that way. I think a lot of people think that, you know, hey, I tip for good service. And it's a reward. Now, I think we should get away from the whole idiotic practice of tipping. I think the price should be what it is, and you should pay workers a living wage so that they can have dependable income and not be at the whim of whoever the customer is, because of the horror stories that I've heard from people who work in the service industry, which again is why they're having such a hard time filling those jobs. It just seems to me that the right thing to do, say, look, put the cost into whatever the meal is and pay those people a reasonable wage. You know, I remember back when I was in college and one of the person I was dating at the time worked at a restaurant and, you know, for tips. And oddly enough, now that I think about it, I think the minimum wage was probably the same back then. No, actually it wasn't. I think it was like a buck something. But it's like $2.90 an hour now. Hasn't gone up in like almost 30 years. But I remember her coming home, you know, a lot of times being just furious that a big table would come in and the bill would be $100 and they'd leave $3. And you go, you worked your behind off for virtually nothing. And then out of that, you're going to have management taking some of it. This is why you need to have strong wage and hour laws. This is the reason you need to have cops on the beat. This is the reason you need to have the ability to report this kind of stuff. And it isn't sexy. It isn't, you know, headline grabbing, which is why our mainstream corporate controlled media doesn't cover it. But these are people's livelihoods. And these are the people who are at the bottom of the economic the economic ladder. These are the people who are struggling to make ends meet. The ones that our Republican friends are trying to kick every single time they want to slash funding. Every single time they want to hold the country hostage to get their pound of flesh. These are the people who struggle. When do we say enough? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast, wherever you find your favorite podcast. You'll find ours. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, Pennsylvania Congressman Chris DeLuzio is going to be here to share some thoughts on the debt ceiling. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1972. That was the day that Maggie Kuhn stood before a group of reporters to tell them about her organization, the Gray Panthers. The idea for the group had started 2 years earlier. 65-year-old Maggie had received the unwelcome news that she was going to be forced to retire from her executive position with the United Presbyterian Church. Maggie was not ready to retire. Instead, she started to organize. This was during the era of the Vietnam War protests, and Maggie found allies with young people who also wanted to see changes in society. The original group developed to build connections between young and old. They called themselves the Consultation of Older and Younger Adults for Social Change. Later, they shifted their name to the catchier Gray Panthers. The Panthers adopted the motto, Age and Youth in Action. In 1975, the Panthers held their first national convention in Chicago. 200 Panthers attended, representing 37 states. At the convention, the Panthers adopted a platform of issues. They included issues important to seniors, such as an end to mandatory retirement, better housing for the elderly, and expansions to rent control. But the platform also included other social justice issues, including support for the Equal Rights Amendment, a call for full employment, amnesty for Vietnam draft resistors, and even, after much debate, the legalization of marijuana. In the more than 40 years since their founding, the Gray Panthers have continued to advocate for a variety of issues. One key achievement was a court victory to make Medicare regulations more understandable to seniors, and they were years ahead of the nation by supporting single-payer health care for all. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Oftentimes, when you suspect you're being gouged by corporate price fixers, you are. Take the rat-a-tat-tat of today's price jumps at supermarkets and chain restaurants. They make you want to rush to the cash register before they raise prices again. No, no, cried the CEOs of food giants. It's not us. It's, quote, supply chain disruptions. Then corporate politicians and economists chime in with old platitudes about the invisible hand of supply and demand. And media know-nothings also pile on, blathering about ne'er-do-wells causing a labor shortage. But hogwash, your suspicions are right. It's plain old price-fixing by avaricious food monopolies. Top executives even brag about it when talking to their bankers and shareholders. McDonald's, for example, recently told investors that, quote, strategic menu price increases in the past 3 months had boosted profits by 63%. Big Mac CEO exulted, I'm really proud of how our system has executed pricing. Never mind that it's their customers being executed. Well, say free market proselytizers, just buy from a competitor. But in nearly all segments of today's food economy, a handful of giants control the market, with each one in on the fix. For example, Chipotle, a McDonald's rival, also jacked up prices in the same three-month period, manufacturing an 84% profit increase. Its CEO then gloated to Wall Streeters, I think we've demonstrated we do have pricing power. This is Jim Hightower saying, by the way, these same giants are also fattening their profits by ripping off their workers. The federal poverty level is now $25,000 a year, with fast food workers typically getting only $3,000 a year more than that bare minimum for a 40-hour week. But there's the gotcha. The profiteering executives hold each worker to about 26 hours a week, creating a sub-poverty labor force for this multi-billion dollar industry. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by use of...
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Well, we're ticking down the days. Only a couple days left till June 1st, and I know the negotiations are going on. I'm still in the mindset, you know, the president's got to just go, look, we got to stop this kind of nonsense. Throw it to the Supreme Court. Let them decide. Because clearly, you're never going to give enough to these Republicans in the moment that we're in. And here to share some thoughts on, you know, the bad, the worse, the ugly. Because I don't see much of an upside here. But I've asked Pennsylvania Representative Chris DeLuzio to come talk with us. Chris, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, Rick, good to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So I see nothing at this point, nothing good possibly coming out of what's going on. The president has begun negotiating, which means that there are probably going to be a bunch of cuts coming. I don't know. Where are things? What are you seeing?
Look, the basic background here is pretty obvious. I mean, the Republicans are involved in a dereliction of duty about raising the debt ceiling for levels of spending and revenue they've had a hand in. And now they're holding our government hostage, threatening to blow up the economy if we don't agree to cuts across the board in our government. And of course, what's never said or mentioned by these guys talking about fiscal responsibility is any kind of rollback of massive tax cuts for billionaires and huge corporations, which have driven up deficits into the trillions. So these people are not being serious about governing, and they're willing to make all of our lives worse and hurt our economy and push us into recession if we don't agree to cut basically everything that makes people's lives a little better through government.
And this is where the frustrating part is, because you're right. We talk about this all the time. They're never going to raise taxes on the people who need it the least, but they're going to punish the people who need it the most. And we see this time and time again. This is not a new game. This has been their MO for a very long time. And using this debt ceiling as the tool to exact their pound of flesh, which is why I've said I think at some point someone has to stop. This, we can't have this artificial debt ceiling. The time to argue over spending is before we spend it, like we do in the Smith household, and we can't keep doing this, putting not just our country at in peril, but the entire globe.
Absolutely. And you know, you make the point here that's an important one. This debt ceiling debate is a crisis that's made up by the Republicans because they don't want to deal with the levels of revenue and spending that they've had a hand in. We can have fights on the budget. We should do it every year and do it in regular order and normal process in Washington. We should not take our economy to the brink and risk having the United States of America default on our debt. That is the dereliction of duty here.
Yeah. Now, yesterday we had Senator Markey on the program talking about his piece of legislation to expand the court. And I'm of the mindset we've got a corporate court. This seems like a good time to use the 14th Amendment, put it in their court, since they side with corporate America all the time. And corporate America is even saying, hey, let's not do this. Let's not throw the entire economy into chaos and cost millions of jobs. And, you know, even, you know, look, the Republicans are whining and complaining that China's talking about starting in their own reserve currency. Maybe not do this and give them an excuse.
And it's not an artificial or made up cost of this. It's a real thing. We undermine our own credibility in the world stage. It'll weaken business, and it's going to hurt people. Whether you're a Social Security recipient, whether you have VA benefits, you pay a mortgage. And any way, and all those ways and more, if we do default, if we do get pushed into a recession as a result, people will suffer.
Now you said if we get pushed into a recession. I'm being told by economists, if we default, there's no question that's where we're going to be. And look, for the last 2 years since Joe Biden took the Oval Office, I've been hearing my Republican friends saying, we're going into recession. It's almost like they want it to happen. And it seems like by doing this, they're not just wanting it, they're willing it to happen. And I think people got to be aware of that.
Well, certainly if you were serious about governing, the last thing you would do would do anything to push us toward a recession. And you would do nothing to undermine the credibility of the United States, our status as the world's reserve currency through the dollar. But that's exactly what they're doing, and they're gambling with that, wondering whether we as Democrats or the president might flinch because we're committed more to protecting our status and the American economy. That tells you something about who you're negotiating with.
Now, the cuts, we've heard a lot, you know, all over the map of cuts. The White House has said that what the Republicans are proposing is a 20%+ cut to the VA, massive cuts to all of the programs and all of the agencies and everything that government does. Is that 23% number accurate? I mean, because I've had some conservatives say, no, that's overblown. Is it accurate when you're talking about veterans in the VA?
It's accurate if you look at what their bill really did, which said, here's a top line number for all non-defense discretionary spending. And to get to those numbers, it's roughly a 22% across the board. Now, they've put out an appropriations bill on veterans and some other things. And in addition to the $2 billion that they clawed back from Veterans Affairs in that bill, they passed the default bill. They've now put out this appropriations bill, and they underfunded a toxic exposure fund by nearly $15 billion. That's a fund that's supposed to be, you know, mandatory guaranteed money to care for burn pit exposed veterans. And what they've done by underfunding it is forcing veterans to have to fight against other veterans programs for funding for those who are going to be eligible under the PACT Act that was passed last year. So okay. Veterans who are exposed to burn pits and toxic substances. So even when they're purporting to try to say they're going to fund veterans care, they didn't do the thing. They left the toxic exposure fund underfunded, which means veterans are going to have to fight to get that funded at the expense of other things within the VA.
You know, it just seems to me that not just, I get when someone says that they're fiscally responsible. When, you know, at my kitchen table, when we sit down to do the bills, sometimes things have to align. But, you know, you don't cut from the things that are central to your core belief structure, to your core needs. And I got to tell you, cutting from Veterans Affairs, cutting from the people that we put on pedestals and called heroes and sent into harm's way and all kinds of photo ops and flag waving, that just seems, I don't know, cruel, mean-spirited, heartless. I'm not sure. I don't know how you do that.
Well, I think it's indefensible. I think this country is a sacred obligation to anyone who served. I'm certainly going to have no part of breaking that bond. And let me just take it back to a basic point about fiscal responsibility. It's not responsible with our budget to let us have billionaires, huge corporations live at historically low tax rates. These guys on trickle-down economics for decades. It doesn't work. It's a fairy tale. And to paraphrase President Obama, there could be an asteroid coming to the earth, and these guys and their answer would be to tax cuts for billionaires. Yeah, it is not good policy. It makes no sense. It's what their instincts are, and it's telling. They're not talking about raising taxes to anything looking like normal rates. They're talking about cutting programs that all of us depend on and rely on.
See, you and I are going to disagree on the trickle-down economics thing. I think it worked perfectly. I think it worked exactly as it was supposed to. It is humming right along. It's creating a large billionaire class, and it's sucking the lifeblood out of the working class, exactly what it was supposed to do. And all of the policies that went to crush unions and crush worker power and crush regulatory oversight so we have safe working conditions, safe water, it's all part of this. So I believe it is working exactly as it's supposed to.
Yeah. Points well taken. I guess I'll concede that one to you. And look, it's not an accident, right? I mean, these guys all sign these pledges. They'll never raise any taxes on anyone or any company ever. That is not rational, responsible policymaking. It is utterly divorced from any sort of normal understanding of economics. And it's where the Republicans are and certainly where their leadership is.
Now, you represent people in Western Pennsylvania. What would a default mean to the working people in your district? You know, I'm sure you guys have mocked up what the kind of job loss and the kind of economic devastation that's going to come to the western part of the state, which is coming back in pretty good ways. What would happen to your district?
Jeopardizing Social Security payments for more than 100,000 families in my district. You know, you've got around 250,000 people in my district who get their health coverage from the VA or Medicare or Medicaid. That would be undermined or weakened here. You look at what a homeowner might see in terms of their mortgage going up, about $100 the average house monthly. That's a serious amount of money that comes out of people's pockets. And that's separate and apart from if this pushes us into a recession and what that might mean for all of us in terms of jobs and pay and everything else. I mean, it's just a pretty terrible set of facts that we could totally avoid.
Yeah.
Should the Republicans, or if the Republicans are willing to just be governing partners here.
Let me ask you, you know, because you spend a lot of time in the cloakroom, I'm sure, and you're talking with Republicans. And I don't want to view them as evil. I don't want to think that there really are people who want to shoot the hostage and throw the country in the chaos. It appears that there are. I mean, from the outside looking in, it appears that we've got a good number of Republicans who really do want to push the button and see what happens if we default, who really do want to shoot the hostage. When you're not on camera, when there's nobody else looking, what are these folks telling you? I mean, are they okay with taking us in the direction we're going, or are they so dug in that they've got to get their pound of flesh that it doesn't matter?
Look, I think there are some folks on the far, far right who are willing to push us into default. And I don't think that's the majority there, but they're certainly there and they have a say. And I think there are folks who think that they've got some leverage to block the debt ceiling being lifted here and are going to use that leverage to extract horrific cuts while keeping the taxes low for billionaires and corporations. It's their ideology. It's what they believe. It's what their donors want. And this is how they're going to use that power.
It's what their donors want. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show with Pennsylvania Congressman Chris DeLuzio. I got to ask you this. Today, I'm sure maybe you've already seen it. One of your colleagues from Georgia, Marjorie Three Names, as we affectionately call her, she evidently introducing articles of impeachment as if the potential of default wasn't bad enough. If that chaos wasn't enough, we are now introducing even more into our system. I got to get your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, it's just an unserious, ridiculous effort. They lack the courage to kick George Santos out of the Congress, and they're going to do this political theater, all while they got in line as a party and refused to impeach the man who tried to overthrow our government through a violent coup on January 6th. So they can miss me with this faux outrage around impeachment.
Now, this is obviously, I got to assume it's obviously going to make its way through. And I'm, I guess I should ask that. Does this make it through to the process of an actual impeachment? Or how do you see this? I got to wonder how McCarthy's going to handle this.
Frankly, short answer is I don't know. And the person who will have more to say than anyone else is the guy you just mentioned. That's Speaker McCarthy's party. And what he decides and what his leadership is going to decide to do with it is anyone's guess.
So let me ask you this. I mean, you know, as somebody, you know, new to Congress, you went in there wide eyed, going to change the world. We're going to get things done. You frustrated and ready to leave yet?
I'm not. I'm still optimistic. You know, I'll tell you, and I'll remind your listeners, I represent the part of Western Pennsylvania right in the border with East Palestine. So my constituents were affected. Some were evacuated when the derailment happened. You know, and I say I'm still optimistic. Look, we saw my bill, the Railway Safety Act, the Senate version, go through committee with a couple Republican votes and Democrats supporting it. I still have some optimism we can do the right thing in the face of crises. We'll see. You know, I had the CEO of Norfolk Southern in my office, I think yesterday. I reiterated to him my strong belief that his company has to do what is right to make whole the people they've hurt, that they should get out of the way and frankly support legislation like mine to make rail safer. Now, they haven't done that yet, and I'm not naive to think that they're going to get on board with something that's going to cost them a few bucks, but that might keep my community safe. But I still have some hope we can get this done.
Yeah, not just your community, but a lot of communities across this country, because I don't know if you've been noticing, the news media has actually been paying attention this year to the number of derailments, and they're, you know, on par with last year or the year before. And there are ways that we could make the rail safer. There are things we could and should be doing. But sadly, we're too distracted with self-inflicted wounds like this idiotic debt ceiling fight, or now with Marjorie Three Names' potential impeachment. I was hoping we might, I don't know, get something done, help working people, help folks get ahead, help people move forward. Sadly, it's all, I guess, bread and circus at this point.
I'm trying to change that. At least, you know, what I can do in the Congress is
we
take the cards that you're dealt, but you know, you fight for some things that matter to people you represent. That's what I'm trying to do.
No, good stuff. What are the marching orders? What should we be paying attention to? What should we be outraged over?
Look, I think, and I'm biased because my constituents and I care a lot about rail safety. Pay attention to what happens with my bill, and if it gets out of the Senate, and if the Republicans are really going to carry water for the railroad, or if they're going to support it. And I should be clear, you know, I've been pretty critical of the Republicans here. I've got a couple of Republicans supporting my bill in addition to those in the Senate. So we can find some partners on some of this, and when we can, we should. I think that's the basics of governing, and when we can find allies across the aisle, we got to find.
There you go. Congressman, I appreciate the time. Good stuff. I look forward to talking to you again. Thanks so much for the good work you do. Congressman Chris DeLuzio. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. That was the day an Oklahoma City jury found in favor of the estate of Karen Silkwood. Karen worked as a lab tech at the Cimarron nuclear plant operated by the Kerr-McGee Corporation. Karen joined the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers International Union during a 1972 strike at the plant. She walked the picket line, returning to work once the strike was ended. Karen remained very concerned about safety standards in the plant, so much so that she decided to serve on the union's bargaining team. She also agreed to secretly collect documentation of the plant's negligence. In November, she did a routine self-check and found she had higher than normal levels of plutonium, an incredibly deadly substance, in her body. Further investigation found her home was contaminated as well. She became convinced that her employer was attempting to poison her. Kerr-McGee accused Karen of poisoning herself to put nuclear companies in a bad light. Despite her fears, Karen pressed on with her investigation. She was on her way to meet with a union representative and a reporter from the New York Times when she died in a mysterious car accident. She was allegedly carrying a manila folder of documents related to her investigation. The documents were never found. Evidence showed that she was likely forced off the road by another vehicle. The jury found the company at fault for the plutonium contamination, awarding more than $10.5 million in damages. The company fought the verdict and eventually settled with the family for $1.38 million. In 1983, Meryl Streep starred in a movie, Silkwood, telling the story of this incredible woman who gave her life fighting for worker safety. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Joanne sent me an email, said, Rick, love the show. Listen to your rant on the Supreme Court. You didn't answer what the worst decision was and which case you would overturn. And I didn't. I didn't get to that. And I'm sorry. Time constraints. For me, I think Citizens United is the worst decision they made. I think the whole making corporations people, making money speech, I think that was one of the worst things that could have been done. And what's thrown out at me, and I love when people do this, they go, well, you know, it just isn't corporations that can spend unlimited amounts of money. Unions can too, and you're a big union guy, so you should be in favor of this, because union can spend a bunch of money. When you look at the numbers, unions are outspent, you know, multiple times. Depending on the person, the numbers you're looking at, 7 to 10 times to 1. You know, is where you're looking at. You know, I've seen on the low end of 7 to 1 corporations outspending labor. I've seen it as high as 10 to 1. And we're not even talking about the kind of money that the billionaires throw in. The reason Republicans are not interested in raising taxes is because that's where they get their money from. And you go, well, Democrats, you know, they They get money from billionaires too. Yeah, they do. They get money from rich people too. And this is where I'm of the mindset. This idea that money is speech and money can buy our politics is insane. I've known people in Congress for years, and they all tell me the same thing. I spend more time raising money than I want to. I spend more time raising money than I do anything else, just about. Because you need to keep churning cash out to run these high, really expensive races. And it's not supposed to be this way. So for me, the idea of doing something on campaign finance was incredibly important. It's something we should be doing. But if you look at what this court has done, you can put their bad decisions into a couple of different baskets. For me, I focus a lot on the horrible labor choices that they make in pushing us back to the Lochner era, where, as I say all the time, if you're hungry enough and desperate enough to work for poverty wages in deplorable conditions, it's your freedom, it's your liberty, taking us back to the good old days of liberty of contract. There's those things. Then there's the money stuff, the corporate power stuff, the dominance stuff, the money is speech stuff. Then there's the voting rights stuff, all of that, all the voter ID, the no longer having to get pre-clearance. There's all of those things. And then there's, you know, the social issues. And it's the social issues that get the most attention. It's the guns, it's the marriage, it's the abortion, it's that stuff. When the reality is the mass of this country, the majority of this country, if we truly were a democracy, and we are not, I know, I'm not saying we are, we're a democratically elected representative republic. I get it. Constitutionally limited representative republic. I get it. Democratically elected. I get it. But if we were a democracy, none of these issues would even be even considered, because the mass of people are in the place that I'm in on these issues. On abortion, I'm not in favor of abortion. I'm pro-safety. I don't want my daughters dying in back alleys. None of us do, and none of us should. Abortion should be safe and legal. Not on demand. Nobody's saying, hey, we should have drive-thrus. You know, I've had arguments with people that if men were the ones bearing children, abortions would be drive-thru. You could get it on the way to get doing something else. Same-sex marriage. Most people are in the same camp. Don't care. None of my business. If two people want to jump into that mess, God bless them. The trans stuff, another issue. Why? Why are we talking about this? Why is it a thing? It's a thing because they need something to outrage us. They need something to rile us up so that we're not paying attention to all of the other things that we agree on. You know, I used to go to CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee thing. And I used to go and I would talk to people about labor issues. And it's interesting how many Republicans are you know, actually pro-labor. Believe in unions and believe in collective bargaining and are there. And how many of my union brothers and sisters are, you know, card-carrying red rib Republicans because my pappy was a Republican. You know, the Eisenhower era. Where I wasn't totally opposed to it. You know, when Eisenhower wrote a letter to his brother, think about this. He wrote a letter to his brother, Edgar, and said, if anyone comes out against Social Security, unemployment, labor laws, the farm bill, any of this stuff, if anyone comes out against this stuff, they'll never be heard from in our political world. Never, never heard from. Now, he said, there are a few Texas oil millionaires, Hunt, there are a couple of these big business people, the moneyed interests, who want these things, but their numbers are negligible, and they are stupid. The reality is stupid has taken over the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, and look, part of the Democratic Party, because you had an era where we were getting along. Let's tatter that safety net. Let's limit the power of workers to organize. Let's find common ground. And this is my fear of where we are in this debt ceiling. We're going to take it out on the poor again. We're going to take it out on the working class again. And the billionaires, they're the ones that are going to continue to profit. It seems pretty simple to me. Let us get together on the things we agree on. We can argue over a beer on the stuff we disagree on. But as a country, we should be focusing on the things that get us moving forward, that help us support our families, that help us move in a direction that we want. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, definitely want to hear it. Miss any portion of the program, podcast, wherever you get your favorite podcast, you will find ours. Thanks for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.